The following podcast is a live recording of a radio show, first broadcast by Fresh FM, with the assistance from New Zealand On Air.
Greetings and welcome to another episode of Climate Matters and to another episode of our series Front-Footing the Future, Getting Our Climate Policy Fit for Purpose. I'm Lindsay Wood. I'm the Director of Climate Strategy Company Resilience Limited, and Climate Matters is brought to you by Fresh FM, the top of the South's community access radio station. It's also broadcast right across the Canterbury region on Plains Media and to the Wire Wrapper on Arrow FM. Well, we have a very full episode with an interview with Professor James Renwick, so I won't say any more now, except to say that I do hope you enjoy the interview. Climate Matters has been privileged to have today's guest on the show previously. James Renwick is a professor of climate science at Te Herenga Waka, Victoria University of Wellington, and is likely well known to many listeners as he is a go-to person on climate issues for Radio New Zealand. James specializes in large-scale circulation of the atmosphere, such as how energy is transferred into it in the tropics and delivered to the Antarctic, which also gives him a keen interest in sea ice formation in the ocean around Antarctica. He's also been an IPCC lead author and a climate change commissioner. Welcome back, James. You're clearly an ideal person to help listeners and me get our thinking up to date on critical climate issues.
Well, thanks very much, Lindsay. It's great to be back on your show.
I think we better start with a general update on what the latest climate science is telling us on vital signs like the temperature anomaly. For listeners that aren't familiar with the word anomaly, that's used to refer to departure from average or normal conditions.
That's exactly right, yeah. I don't have any good news, I guess I would say. The World Meteorological Organization put out a report recently there, summary on the state of the climate from 2025. And yeah, they talk about increased levels of greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide, increased amounts of heat in the oceans, increasing sea level rise, et cetera, all the things we've heard about many, many times. So there's still no sign of any real action on climate change in terms of reducing emissions. They just keep on going up, stopping increasing greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. That would be a wonderful thing to see, but there's no sign of it yet.
Is there anything that we should be discussing about tipping points and possibly crossing them?
There has been some new work in the last few weeks, actually, looking at the AMOC. And it's basically, it's a code for the deep ocean circulation, and the Gulf Stream and the sinking in the North Atlantic is a crucial part of that. As is the same story around Antarctica, there's several points where they're sinking to the deep ocean and so on. So anyway, this deep current carries a vast amount of heat around the world. If it shut down, it would rearrange global climate in a way that would be extremely hard to deal with. But recent work has been looking at the latest batch of climate model simulations from the last IPCC report. And what they did was they adjusted the model forecasts or simulations based on the observations of this AMOC that we have over the last 25 years or so. Suddenly, once you do this adjustment against the observations, you find that almost all the model simulations show a significant decrease in the volume of this flow, meaning the models are pretty consistently saying that the AMOC is definitely slowing down, and it's now considered to be a 50% chance that it will get to the point it would shut down this century. The voices, the stories I've read, the papers I've read recently are consistently saying, yeah, it's looking much more likely than we thought even a couple of years ago.
And unfortunately, it seems to be in line with what we're hearing rather more often than we'd like, that the earlier projections and earlier IPCC reports and so on, as time goes on, we're finding it's often worse than the projections rather than better. Am I right in that?
Yes, that's right. And it's not that something I hear quite often, oh, the IPCC is very conservative and it's written by a committee, so they never say anything dramatic. Well, that's not true. They do. It's just the feature of the fact that the science is evolving so rapidly that By the time you publish one of these IPCC reports, it's already out of date.
I mentioned in the intro that your interest in large-scale atmospheric circulation pointed also to Antarctic sea ice.
Indeed.
And I wonder if we could segue into that. And perhaps you'd start by explaining why the extent of Antarctic sea ice is really is a big deal.
The Antarctic sea ice field, which sits around the edge of the continent of Antarctica, is an amazing thing. It grows every year almost from scratch, because over the summer, almost all of that ice melts. It's just frozen seawater. So there's almost none of this ice around Antarctica in the summer. And then every year, it grows out to about 19 million square kilometres. It's about the same area as the continent of Antarctica. So in some senses, you could say
that's Antarctica incredible.
Becomes twice the size in the winter than it is in the summer. It's the biggest seasonal cycle on the planet, which in itself is impressive and makes it important. But one of the main reasons it is important to the global climate system is that when this ice forms, salt that's in the water that's freezing gets squeezed out, and that makes the water in the upper ocean denser, heavier, so it tends to sink. So as you were saying, it forms part of this AMOC business. So when the sea ice is forming, it creates this dense water which allows it to sink, and that water becomes part of the deep ocean circulation. So what the sea ice is doing is actually one of the main drivers of this deep ocean circulation. So if the amount of sea ice around Antarctica disappeared significantly, that would have a big knock-on effect for the deep circulation. Antarctic sea ice has been varying in strange ways in recent years. So it's another worry. We don't know exactly what the effect is, but it's as important, at least, as any slowdown in the Gulf Stream up in the North Atlantic. So it's a big deal. And maybe finally, I'm rambling on a bit here, but
It's important.
There's the global energy balance component. You know, ice is reflective. When it's there, it's reflecting sunlight away. And, you know, actually, most of the sea ice is there in the winter when there isn't any sunlight over Antarctica, so maybe it's not as big a deal as you might think. But it does reflect sunlight when the sun is shining on it, and it does affect the global reflectivity, the so-called albedo of the planet. So if you take ice away, that makes the planet less reflective, which means it's more able to absorb solar radiation that helps to warm up the whole planet.
Everything is connected, isn't it? And so I just before we leave this, with the prospect or possibility of big decline in the AMOC and possibly some of the deep southern circulation, what would people in New Zealand think as a result of that? What sort of policy the government might be scratching its head over to try and ready us for that?
The deep ocean circulation turns out in the global average, it takes energy from the southern hemisphere and deposits it in the northern hemisphere. It's quite amazing. It transports heat energy across the equator. It makes the northern hemisphere warmer than it would be otherwise, and especially the North Atlantic, hence the AMOC name.
Yes.
So if it shut down, the northern hemisphere would get colder and the southern hemisphere would get warmer, and it would change the distribution of rainfall, especially in the tropics, change the distribution of sea level rise and so on. Yeah, there would be big effects. It would certainly cool Western Europe and Eastern North America pretty significantly. You know, we're talking in places up to maybe 10 degrees, way more than the warming we've had already. So it'd be a big deal for the regional climate around the North Atlantic. And, you know, and New Zealand and a lot of the southern hemisphere warm up faster than it has already. So it would really put the heat on us, literally. And it would cause shifts in storm tracks. So the Southern Ocean westerlies and the storms associated with that would move. Probably we would move into the sense of the storm track and the westerlies being a bit further north. So New Zealand may well experience more windy conditions and more stormy conditions, such as what we saw late last year. But I think, you know, whatever happens with temperatures and sea levels around New Zealand would be the least of our worries. If you are impacting the climate of Europe, US, Canada, and as well as, you know, Asia, et cetera, significantly, that's going to cause massive economic impacts. It would, knock a hole in the global economy. It would affect our ability to export. It would affect global geopolitics massively, and that would be more of a headache for New Zealand's government. It would be something to really avoid. It could lead to all manner of bad effects, you know, food shortages, inability to feed and water large populations in Asia or in Europe and so on.
It's a lot to get the head around, isn't it? And I wonder, as you were talking, I was thinking, where does that leave New Zealand? We think of ourselves as a food-producing country, which of course we are. We've got maybe a global north, which is going to be more in need of having its food grown somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And yet we are facing maybe trying to grow more food, but in a context where our climate is changing or where there is resistance to methane producing food chains and things like that. Are there any signals for where New Zealand agriculture would be wise to be thinking of heading? Is that pushing you too far outside your comfort zone?
Yeah, I have a few reckons, I suppose, but it's a bit out of my scientific comfort zone. But I would say that, you know, New Zealand, you often hear the statement, New Zealand feeds the world. Well, New Zealand feeds a few tens of millions of people outside of the country. That's not the world exactly, but we contribute. What springs to my mind is we're probably getting away from dairy farming and turning a lot of that land into grain production or pulses or, you know, soybeans. You could get more food outdoor that way rather than going for these very energy intense products like milk and milk powder.
I wonder if that's a point to segue onto the question of our greenhouse gases and especially those that come from agriculture, because as you know better than I do, methane is a big part of our national greenhouse gas emissions, about 43%. I think it would help us all to understand a little bit about the behavior of methane in comparison with other big greenhouse gases like carbon dioxide and nitrous oxide.
Yeah.
Could you unpick that a little bit for us?
Sure thing. And it's been a big discussion in recent years. So the story here is we have two kinds of greenhouse gases, the so-called long-lived greenhouse gases that stay in the air for a century or more, and carbon dioxide is the longest-lived of those, versus the short-lived gases, such as methane, which are in the air maybe only for a decade or so. The flow of methane into the air keeps the concentration up. As soon as you turn off the tap or even turn it down, the concentration in the air starts to decrease because it has a short lifetime. Whereas gases like carbon dioxide, especially, are called stock gases, that you put some of it into the air and it stays there. That's why the carbon dioxide has built up so much in the last couple of hundred years. You've got to turn off the tap completely just to stabilize the amount in the atmosphere. It still isn't going to start reducing for a century or more. So we're stuck with it, essentially. And to stop climate change, we need to stop emitting carbon dioxide, especially. All we have to do with methane is turn down the tap a bit, and that will start to reduce the amount in the atmosphere. So it's, in terms of policy, it's quite different. For the long-lived gases, you've got to get to zero emissions, or net zero. That's a whole other discussion, whether it should be gross zero or net zero. But for short-lived gases, and methane's the main one, you just reduce emissions by a few percent to start with, at least, and that starts to reduce the amount in the atmosphere. So that starts to be a cooling effect. Methane is excellent, much better than carbon dioxide at absorbing heat from the earth.
And I'll just make the point to listeners that absorbing heat is what we don't want.
Yes. Do want. I would say we should be doing both. We should be reducing all greenhouse gas emissions. Yes, we do have to focus on carbon dioxide and get to zero. But at the same time, we should be reducing methane emissions because that gives us a short-term cooling and it buys us a bit of time.
I'm going to try and take us into the somewhat controversial space of New Zealand's methane policy, because I know we operate a policy framed around the concept of what they call no additional warming. Now, I know that there's been a lot of people, including a bunch of experts in the middle of last year, who wrote to the Prime Minister pointing out the fallacy of that as a policy. Would you mind unpicking for us the no additional warming?
So this no additional warming thing, it comes back to what I was just saying about methane's lifetime and all the rest of it. If you reduce methane emissions, that reduces the amount in the atmosphere pretty quickly, and that is a cooling effect. If you keep the amount in the atmosphere, the concentration, constant, then that means the warming effect of that methane doesn't change. So this is the no additional warming idea. Tweaking the emissions so that the amount in the atmosphere stays the same as a no additional warming effect, or as Rod Carr, the former chair of the Climate Change Commission, put it, no additional cooling. I like that framing better. Anything that would cool the Earth from here would be a brilliant thing to do. I don't buy this no additional warming argument. It is a way of giving the agriculture sector a free pass. So I would rather farmers were able to say, yes, we're actually helping to cool the earth and avoid tipping points and, getting on top of this problem. It becomes not a scientific question, it's a political question. How you trade off food production, which in a lot of ways produces methane, against cooling the planet by reducing methane emissions is, it's a sort of moral question.
It's a bit like having a stream flowing through your property and you've been polluting it for years, and then saying, well, as long as you don't pollute it any extra, it's okay. And it's not
Yeah,
okay.
that polluting a stream example is a great analogy. Yeah, who wouldn't want to clean up the water in the stream?
James, we could talk a lot about methane, but I want to indulge a little quirk that's been nagging at my brain for a while. And if my understanding is correct, the oceans have soaked up about 90% of the extra heat that has resulted from climate change so far. Thank goodness it's done that, because if all that heat was in the atmosphere, the planet would be unlivable, wouldn't it?
We'd be fried by now. That's right. Yes, thankfully, the ocean has been doing that work. It's allowed us to keep living, basically. Temperatures would have gone up 30 or 40 degrees already if all that heat had gone to the
That's
atmosphere.
staggering. And we're worried about 1.5 degrees. But the thing is that I can imagine as the ocean get warmer and warmer, its capacity to keep absorbing heat, I can imagine, will reduce. That's going to leave more heat for the atmosphere to soak up, and therefore triggering a rise in atmospheric temperature.
You're right, but there's a long way to go before the ocean really starts to reject that heat. Water has an amazing heat capacity. It can soak up vast amounts of energy, and that's why we don't see the temperature of the oceans. Because the oceans aren't boiling, even though we've added, trillions of joules of energy to the oceans over the last few decades. So there's a lot of capacity yet the oceans can absorb. Heaps more energy. But there are knock-on effects. One of the other main things the oceans absorb is carbon dioxide. So about a quarter of the CO2 that we emit goes into the oceans. And that ability to absorb carbon dioxide is a function of temperature. Warmer water can hold less carbon dioxide. So as you warm the oceans, that so-called sink of carbon dioxide weakens and you get more of this stuff in the air. So it would accelerate the warming effect of the CO2 emissions that we're currently making. One of the main reasons sea levels are rising is the added heat in the oceans. Like anything really, when you heat water, it expands. And so that's about a third of the total sea level rise we've seen so far.
I'm going to jump from the macro to the micro now, because I can imagine listeners have been hearing us talk about atmospheric circulation and deep at the AMOC, and then probably thinking, well, that's all interesting, but what can I do as an individual? Is there anything in there that I have personal agency over?
Yes, and being engaged in the problem, I think, is the number one thing. Just being aware of what's going on and having an ability to talk about it. We don't talk about climate change enough, I think. We need to normalize talking about climate change with our families, with our neighbors, with our workmates, etc. That's how you get action, I think. politicians do what the population asks them to do, tell them to do. We need action. You know, you see these surveys, you know that 80% of New Zealanders want more action on climate change, but we don't have 80% of New Zealanders telling our politicians that. And that's, you might not think that's climate action, but if everyone in a electorate did that, the MP was told by their staff member, hey, we got 10,000 emails saying we want more action on climate change. I think that would have an effect on policy, and that's, at that level, that's where we really need to see change.
You have no idea how timely your comment is. We're recording this on the 6th of May.
May, yes.
On the 7th of May, Nelson Council has been asked to vote on a strategic guidelines for its long-term plan, which has dropped any reference to climate change. And so right at the moment, we're in the middle of emailing all the councillors, going to go and put as many people as we can in the council chamber tomorrow morning. Maybe when this is broadcast, which won't be for a few weeks, I will be able to give an update of what happened.
That's a great opportunity to make your voice heard, because that's exactly what they want to be talking about or not talk about, as the case may be.
Here is that update. The day before the council meeting to consider the strategic priorities, there was a whole sequence of emails. I've heard of numbers of 40 to 100 went to councillors from all sorts of different places. On the morning of the council meeting, there was a substantial protest outside the council buildings in the council chamber itself. The gallery was actually full of people. The councillors themselves made repeated reference to the fact that there were not only a lot of emails, but a lot of different ones. They weren't just cut and paste copies. The gallery was still full when the actual strategy was being discussed. There was an inclusion of environmental and climate initiatives as a strategic priority. I interrupted you.
I think it's something that the oil industry have pushed recently, the idea that it's all down to individuals' actions. We do need to see change at the government level, at the big business level, to just pull the levers to make being low carbon an easy option. And that aside, individuals can still make a difference. It's about taking public transport instead of driving your car, using active transport, you know, walking or cycling instead of driving your car. Anything that reduces your use of fossil fuels, reduces your use of energy.
Of course, we have at the moment got a major global event, reduce our fossil fuel usage and become aware of all the huge number of downstream products that come from it. The
Indeed.
Straits of Hormuz situation, does that have a bearing on our discussion here, do you think?
Oh, absolutely. And I've read a lot of commentary lately about the implications of this war in Iran. And the thing is, with the supplies of fossil fuels becoming much more uncertain, that's really pushed countries around the world, consumers around the world, into buying EVs, into wanting to put solar panels on their roof, etc. It's really boosted the rollout of renewable energy resources and of sort of green technology like electric vehicles, electric bikes, electric everything. Maybe we could be less dependent, we could be more resilient by having more of our own energy production in our country, and that's where the wind farms and the solar panels come into the stories. Yeah, human nature is such that, you know, once the crisis is over, everyone just goes back to normal behaviour. And I've really come to understand through looking at all the stuff about the war in Iran and Hormuz, etc., that fossil fuels pervade pretty much everything that we do, and all the products we use, it's totally linked to global economic activity. And how you get yourself out of that hole, I really don't know.
James, I always wind up with more questions to ask you, but we're pushing our time limit a little bit. Are there any further comments or issues or anything that you want to talk about?
Oh, yes, the super El Nino, that's another slightly frightening thing on the horizon. And the latest model results suggest that, yes, it could be a super El Nino. If it goes the way some of these past events have gone, we might expect, you know, serious, significant drought conditions in the east of both islands, probably a cold, stormy summer coming up, and very dry in Hawke's Bay and Marlborough, Canterbury. And, you know, that would have a big effect on food production, on our economy, et cetera. So it's a worry, but it's a bit uncertain just how it's going to shape up.
Right. Look, James, it's always lovely talking with you. I do have to say cheerio at this point because you've been very generous with your time. So thanks so much again for joining me.
You're very welcome, Lindsay. It's a great conversation. Cheers.
Isn't it great to have people like James Renwick front up for this series on Front Footing the Future? Next week, we'd be pleased to bring you Dr. Mike Joy, well-known freshwater ecologist and champion of much more. He's known on Radio New Zealand and so on. The week after that is Professor Colin Butler, who may be less well-known in New Zealand, but is a world authority on health and climate, and he's based in the Australian National University. Thanks again for your company. I do hope I enjoy it again next week. And as always, kia kaha for the climate. Climate Matters is brought to you by Fresh FM, the top of the South's community access radio station. Fresh FM broadcasts in Blenheim on 88.9, Eastern Golden Bay on 95.0, to the Nelson CBD on 107.2, and across the Nelson Tasman region on 104.8. It's also streamed to the planet on freshfm.co.nz, and podcasts of Climate Matters and also of other locally produced shows are available through freshfm.co.nz.
The podcast you just listened to was a live recording of a radio show, first broadcast by Fresh FM, with support from New Zealand On Air. Fresh FM is a community access media station based in Te Tauihu, the top of the South Island, New Zealand. The funding of Access Media makes these podcasts possible. To find similar programs by other community media stations, go online to accessmedia.nz. If you or your group would like to know more about how you can have a program on our station, please contact us. Visit our website, freshfm.co.nz, for our contact details.